Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
Love the power of prayer, that moment of silence, and we go to God in prayer together. And I think tonight we're going to look at that and see the power in that, I hope, as well as the boisterous sound. You know, before that, everyone's talking. There's an energy and a vibe that, you know, feels good to be around each other. And there's power in that. And tonight, we're going to look at my favorite Old Testament mic drop moment, for sure. It's just fun to talk about. It's a cool story, I think. And at least from a standpoint of storytelling, it's just a good story. And one thing I want to remember that Barry mentioned last time, these are real people. You know, when we study these books, let's remember as we dive in, when we look at these texts, we're going to read a lot tonight because I'm going to talk about some context, but no better way than just read God's Word as well. But when we read, remember, we're not looking in a window into the past. We're looking at a mirror, right? We're not looking at a window to say, look at them, how dare they, or look at them, hooray. It's to look and we share in their triumphs and their tragedies, and it's for us to learn, because how dare us, right, if we don't? And I think that's something we need to remember. So we're going to look at tonight, getting into continuing our series. I started, kind of setting up last time. I want to give a lot of context and a little more tonight, but really three things Adam and I want to do every week, right? We want to give historical context so we make it feel as real as possible, because that's what we need to be in the moment. We want it, you know, we talk about the money, the people, the rulers, what they're going through, to remember these are events. This is not just a history book, but they're not folk tales to us. This is history, but this is us, right? We should see ourselves there. So that's one thing. We want to feel it. We want to be in the moment and hopefully understand what these people are going through. Second thing is we want to give enough set the scene, right? When we do that, to say, here's where we go, and here's what we're doing in this moment, so we can celebrate that moment. And then third, how do we apply that today, right? So we're going to do that. So jumping back in to a little more setup here, is we're going to talk about Elijah versus the prophets of Baal. And again, I no Hollywood blockbuster could do it justice, but I can just hear the soundtrack in my head. But I will say, as a kid, the first part of the story was the most exciting. I think as I get older, toward the end is the real mic drop moment to me that I appreciate more and more. But Judges 2, if you'll go there for me, would someone read Judges 2 verses 8 to 13 for me, if you've got it?
And Joshua, the son of Nun, servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years. And they buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, in the north of the mountain of Gaash, all the generation that were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. They abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods and from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth.
Hopefully a lot of names popping up we've talked about, right? This pantheon, right? And to remind us that it wasn't long after Joshua, it didn't take long, right? Before they began to fall away from God. Generation passes. They've already forgotten the Lord, the Baals and the Ashtoreths, Asherahs, however you want to say it. There's a lot of different pronunciations. verse 13 talks about them. And let's remember, this is sort of what we see a map of those states to begin with. When we see the kingdom of Israel and Judah, we left off with a divided kingdom, right? And keep in mind tonight and for the next week when we go back, again, our enemies here, right? The Arameans, the Aramaic language comes from there, Assyria. So we go from this, right? We go from, we have this over here, and we see that the settling of the kingdoms here. And when we eventually get to, here's a map here that kind of shows better that split kingdom, right? And there's a few places we're going to look at as we set up Elijah's battle, right? We want to focus on that moment. So many cool things, but to get us to there, we need to remember, right? We're going to be in the northern kingdom here, and This is a map that maybe brings us up to here. I like this one because there's a few places we want to pay attention to. Excuse me. So this is going to involve Elijah, and we're going to mention Elisha later, but this is about the 10th century, 9th century, and we have Samaria, right, where Ahab is ruling, right? We have Mount Carmel. It's going to be the site of our epic showdown, right, up there. And we have a sense of kind of miles here we can kind of see. We've got about a 20, 25 miles between there. We have Jezreel, okay? We see that mentioned. Got to remember, that's where Jezebel hangs out mostly. And that's where Ahab summers his palace, right? But Samaria is the palace. Jezreel is where they tend to stay, a little closer to Jezebel's hometown of Tyre. We also have Ramoth-Gilead and a few other important places we'll kind of cover over time. But these are places that are going to be important later. One thing I want you to notice at this map, and I kind of go quickly, I guess, but got this little area. If you notice kind of where Gilead is, in here, at this point, it goes a little farther, okay? There was a point here we're going to get to where I want us to see that this map here, by the time of Ahab, they've lost some territory, right? We're going to get to that probably, maybe hint the end toward the beginning, and that's going to lead to Ahab's end. It's the Ramoth-Gilead, the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead. It's going to not go so well for Ahab. But we come in, I'll mention a couple of things I mentioned last time. I showed this last time, but I want to make a point. A couple of these artifacts we see that ground us, right? There's the Misha Stele, one of the few artifacts that actually says Yahweh and mentions the face of Chemosh, one of the gods, one of the names for Baal in some cultures. Remember the people of Aram, Assyria, Moab, Sidon, Tyre, Phoenicia, they all knew who Yahweh was, but they didn't know who God was. Why was that? So they know who Yahweh is, right? But how come they don't know that that's God? What's your answer to that? Because they knew who Yahweh was, kind of. But whose fault is it that, you know, the people there don't really know what this God is? What do you think?
Israel.
How so?
They're not following.
What's that?
They're not following.
Yeah, they're not following. There's a lot of, I mentioned last time, henotheism, monolatry, that idea where they say, well, we kind of worship, we believe there's a lot of gods, but we're just going to worship this one. God says that's not enough. Well, we believe you're it. You're the strongest of the gods. That's not enough either, right? We got a lot of compromise going on. So at this point, they know who God is. It's Yahweh. It's the God of the storms, God of the sky, God of the mountain. That's going to come back and bite Ahab later, right? A little bit. Judges 2, 10 to 13 tells us, right? They don't know them because at this point, they neither knew the Lord or what he had done. They're following the wrong people, the wrong gods. Another thing I want to mention, just kind of that I think is cool, that kind of grounds our history. Does anybody know what an ostracon is? Ever seen one of those? So they're broken bits of pottery, and these have been found more and more recently. They're broken shards of pottery. They're essentially used as scrap paper. They would break a jar or something like that, or break pottery and have these, and they would carve into them messages. They are also used as what they called abecedaries, which is kind of the alphabet. And the reason this is important is they would use this to write on, send notes and things. And they find a lot of this during this dated at the time of Solomon and David. One big thing about that is a lot of them, depending on when you date them, cover both Phoenician and Hebrew. Now, that's a problem because it shows some of the compromise. See some of the pagan languages already there in the heart of the kingdom. And we also, though, it also gives some proof to the, if you want to dig deeper, another study, David and Solomon, their propensity for literature, their writing and everything. There's evidence, again, that they had a big scriptorium there. They've uncovered lots of, they would only have these if it was some people who wrote a lot of poetry and songs. And we have these. There's a discovery called the Tel Zait inscription, which dates to that compromised 9th century. And I think it's kind of a cool thing, too, because that's where we get the root word for ostracized from, because they would often take that, if you're going to run people out of a town, they would meet at the gate. We talk a lot about gates in our sermons. They would smash a jar. Each one of them would vote. And if you got voted out, you were out by the ostracon, that's where we get, you're ostracized. You don't want to be ostracized. There you go. But that kind of stuff we see in this period. a couple of things that, again, lead us up to Elijah's battle here. I mentioned part of this last time. There are two monoliths we know from the time of King, and Adam hinted toward this too. Before we get 200 years in the future to Sennacherib, we have Shalmaneser III, an Assyrian king. Now, he's important because we have a battle of Karkar-Stili. This is a monolith that talks about the kings that fought him. And Ahab was one of them. This is when things were going pretty good for Ahab, right? This is leading up to what's about to happen. We know that it's called the land of Omri. The land, people knew them, the house of Omri, house of David, Ahab of Israel. It also mentions, I didn't say this last time, Hadad-Ezer of Aram-Damascus. Hadad-Ezer is mentioned in Scripture. In 1 Kings 18:14, we see talking about Ahab's city of Jezreel. Okay, we know Jezreel's mentioned on here. It talks about Ahab of Israel from Jezreel. And Hadad-Ezer is the current king of Aram Damascus. Okay, that's important because that's going to change by the end of this story. And this story is not just about Elijah. This is about God saying, I'm going to change the geopolitical structure of the entire region. Right? And you're going to watch. That's what he's saying. Another one I didn't get to last time, I want to show. This one's kind of neat. this is one of two obelisks in the area found in perfect condition almost, called the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser III. Sounds like a horror movie, right? There's a white obelisk too, and it's from Nineveh. That's for another story. You can probably guess what that's about. But Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser, same period. It's important because it records a victory over a man much later named Jehu. And this is supposed to be Jehu kneeling down. The bigger thing here shows Israelites giving tribute. Anybody remember who Jehu is?
Both. What's
the wild chariot driver. What else did Jehu do? Who did he become? Remember him? We may not. We read these stories so much, we forget. I do. Remember Jehu? We're going to get to him later. Spoiler, Jezebel does not do well at his hands. Jehu does a pretty good job, but his fate is here, ultimately at the feet of the kings of men. He comes real close, like a lot of these guys. Lastly, the Tel Dan Stele I showed last time. This is one of the first proofs of David, the house of David. And there are a few verses. I don't think we'll necessarily read all these for time, because I definitely want to get to our text. But if you want to look at these later, 2 Kings 10:31, 2 Kings 12, 2 Kings 13, each of those mention a man named Hazael, okay? Hazael of Damascus. He's a nobody until God says he's not anymore, okay? Hazael is going to be important later, and we actually have history of that before we move on. These are statues of both Shalmaneser and of the man named Hazael, and on the statues they would put inscriptions of their victories, people they liked, people they hated. And what's interesting, if you read these scriptures here, it talks about Hazael, the son of no one. Hazael is going to be anointed king later. And he's going to tell the prophet, I'm a son of a dog. Well, he's not the only one to say that. In history, we have a record of Shalmaneser being angry because the king Ben-Hadad is going to be overthrown by a son of nobody, he says, who sees the throne. It's in history. It's really cool when that comes together. And that man is found in 2 Kings 8. We're going to see that probably more of next week, okay? But these are all the events happening around this. So we've got to deal now with a few things. Before we get to Elisha, Jehu, and Hazael, which I'm just going to mention, we've got to see Elijah have his moment, okay? Which is God's moment. God's plan is in motion. We're going to have some confrontations and a miracle. As a review, this is what I said about Jezebel last time, because Jezebel's not really in the story till the end, okay? She's not present here, okay? I think for a couple of reasons. Ahab is. But we need to remember Jezebel is no consort, right? This woman came from a line of priest kings in Tyre. She was considered, according to them, their priest king, the avatar of Asherah, okay? They thought she was the living embodiment of their god of fertility. That's why they gave her so much power. She was a royal priestess. So we need to remember that. She held a lot of power, okay? And I mentioned this last time. It didn't show a lot. We don't have a lot of records, but those Asherah poles I mentioned last time, somebody asked for some pictures. There are a couple, a lot of the more grotesque ones have been destroyed. Some of them were more phallic, things like that, or like trees. Some of them were more like a tall woman, or they were trees drawn on things. And those were the things God wanted tore down. None of these sort of tree images that represented the fertility goddess, okay? And then we get to Baal. And I closed last time by telling you to remember that we have a few gods in this area. Molech's the big bad child sacrifice guy. Baal also dealt in child sacrifice. But if you remember, Baal's domain was the god of the sky, thunder, fire, and rain, as well as fertility. It's kind of important for what we're about to see. God knows what he's doing, right? Sky, thunder, fire, and rain. He's also known as the master of sea and death, okay? And we also read about Asherah, but we'll talk about her later. So a couple here. Would somebody mind helping me read these? If so, I do want to read these. Someone could grab these four scriptures, Psalm 68:4, Psalm 18:13, Isaiah 28:2, and Isaiah 27:1. I want to establish something real quick, because at this point, this is when Elijah shows up. There are parallels between Yahweh, or God, according to them, and Baal. And I think this is why God's had enough, okay? Too much syncretism going on. If someone could read those passages for me, once you have them, go ahead and just read what you have. Tell me what it is, and let's read.
Psalm 68:4. God's in name. Lift up a song to him who rides through the deserts. His name is the Lord. Exalt before him.
Does anyone else have a different translation? Psalms of the Desert. Somebody look that up. Rider of the Desert. Say anything else? Okay. Next verse.
Psalm 18:13. The Lord thundered from heaven. The voice of the Most High resounded.
Okay. Thunder from heaven resounded. Next.
Isaiah 28:2. Look, the Lord has one who is mighty and strong, like a storm of hail, a destroying storm, and like a storm of mighty waters overflowing, he will cast them down to the earth with his hand.
Okay, storms, water, casting down. Last one, please. What is it we have left?
Isaiah 27:1. Okay. In that day, the Lord, with his hard and great and strong sword, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent, and he will slay the dragon that is in the sea.
Okay. Now, I'm not arguing that somebody's copying, but somebody cheated, okay? This is God. These are God's texts. Now, one of the reasons they're having a problem here is the Baal cycle. This is why Baal's a problem, because on purpose, you have the cults of Jezebel and Tyre. They know the stories because they've heard the Israelites, but their text of the Baal cycle involves this deity coming down and fighting the god of death and conquering the sea, and they have their own holy text called the Ugarit cycle, Ugarit Baal cycle, and I'm just quoting a couple of things from theirs. It mentions some of the epithets for him, and as for you, take your clouds, your winds, your thunderbolts, your rains. It calls Baal, I didn't want to put them all here, but a lot of what you just read in their scripture, they refer to him as rider of the clouds, lord of the desert. Somebody's kind of bowing up to God here, right? Baal is the only cult to do this. Everything they do, conveniently, and especially as Jezebel shows up, the scriptures start to show up, right? That's how they turn them. Well, this is the true God. You can worship Yahweh. Okay, he deals with higher matters. He doesn't love you, really. Baal can make you happy now. You come to my cult. I'm just going to say how it is, right? Their cult was about sex. It was about lust. I'm going to feed you. Eat, drink, and be merry. Laissez bon temps rouler, right? Live and let live. Why not go to that, right? She had convinced them. So we have a lot of problems. Baal even had some myths start to show up about slaying a dragon at sea, beating the Leviathan, commanding the rain. Sound familiar? Okay. So I want us to say that because at this point is conveniently when we see Elijah show up. God says, all right, time to deal with the problem. So who is Elijah? We're going to go to 1 Kings now. Let's go to 1 Kings 17, and we're going to look at some of this. When we set up here, Elijah, his name is, my God is Yahweh, or yeah, my God is the Lord, or my Lord is the God. 1 Kings 17, we see him listed as a Tishbite from Tishbe. Gilead, I didn't put the map up here, but it's kind of over to the right. 17:8, it kind of talks about he had a garment of hair and had a leather belt around his waist. Again, that imagery of the wild man. I mentioned last time, Ronnie, you had an answer about, you know, we have this John the Baptist. We have other holy men that kind of did look like that. We'll give everybody that. A lot of traditions have the wild man in the woods wearing a loincloth and living off the land, you know. But why didn't they just kill Elijah, Ronnie? I mean, he was causing trouble at this point. Strike him down. What was it you said last time? Do you remember? Okay, well, you did good. You did it last time. He was a holy man. That was important. Now, these people were superstitious, all right? Let's remember that. Paul calls these people out later, too, even in Greece, right, when he talks about the superstitions. This carries on for a while. And they, even though Ahab and Jezebel were abandoning God, they didn't quite abandon him too much. You know, we don't mess with a holy man for another reason, too, because the people were easily swayed. You kill Elijah without making a point first, you got a martyr on your hands, right? They didn't care about spiritualism, but what they did care is about maintaining the taxes, maintaining the cash flow, the economy. They're a superpower at this point. Don't rock the boat. Right? And the people, that was enough of an opiate for them, right? They were like, that's fine. You kill Elijah, then you risk maybe angering Yahweh. That's still not quite right, right? But you know, they are getting there. All right, so they don't do that. But what we see, things to note here in the text in 1 Kings 17 to 19, we see Mount Carmel, right? Carmel is what it is, something of God, mountain of God. It stands for Karam, which is garden or beautiful, or vineyard. It means beautiful green place of God, okay? That's what it means. Still is. It's beautiful then. A test of fire and faith is what we're about to see. a lot of confidence, some humility. I would argue confidence, but hopefully I'll have some room for discussion if somebody wants to. I'm always curious what everybody thinks about Elijah in this text. I like him, okay? But Jezebel's not here. She's back in the palace of Jezreel, I think for a couple reasons. Ahab is here, though. We're going to talk about Elijah's reaction. So this is looking down from a modern-day picture from one of the peaks, looking down, imagine, off of Mount Carmel into the Jezreel Valley. Okay, so you can see across a long way for miles. Mount Tabor is this way, Nazareth this way, just generally kind of where they're at. This is kind of a rock city moment, okay? We're looking out. You can be in seven states at once, seven gods at once. Mount Gilboa is that way. A lot of things just to get our presence. From what I can tell, too, in my own research, I think Mount Carmel is about 1,800 feet above sea level. That's about 200, 300 feet shy of Lookout Mountain, which is my only point of reference, I think, at this point. Not a big fan of heights. Imagine you're over there at Ruby Falls. You're looking down. You can pretend like you're throwing fire down, okay? But that's kind of what we're talking about. It was a strategic place, right? It was an old altar there in a high place, right, which had been torn down. That's kind of part of the story. It means garden or orchard. Now, why is this place, which is known as the holy place, and Egyptians wrote about this too. I don't have time, but there's 15th century documents about pharaohs talking about, hey, there's a holy mountain here. We don't mess with that. Why would the holy mountain of the fertile orchards not be an important place for Baal and Asherah? What do you think? Pretty things, beautiful things, the groves, right? This place was gorgeous. You follow Baal and Asherah. Who is your God? Who's Yahweh? God of the deserts? It's dry out there. It's better here, right? It's not God who did it. It's Baal who did it, okay? This is an important place, okay? This is their holiest of holies. God of the sky, rain, and male fertility. Asherah is the goddess and consort of fertility. We'll cover this more in a minute, but let's go ahead and throw it out there. Their rituals were very lewd, right? You know, when it talks about early on in Deuteronomy, talks about not what to do, and we see in Joshua, Judges, we see conversations that mention things like, and the men went and slept with their women, they took prostitutes, and then they went before this and that. It wasn't just that. They were worshiping, right? They were meeting priestesses. That's how they went to worship. When you went to confession, and if you think of it in a Catholic sense, it was a confession, you know. They had male priests that would meet the women, you know, women priests, you know, there was a whole thing. And you did that because their whole belief was, hey, we're reenacting, pretty convenient too, right? Hey, I got to go to church. We're going to reenact the Baal cycle, the god of the sky and the woman, the female god of the earth. They're going to mate and they're going to bring on all this plenty. Yeah, well, they'll go to that church, right? That's what they're doing. These people are saying they're going there and it's lewd. God's pretty angry about this, right? It's dehumanizing his people. Now, we see in verse 1 to 6, the Tishbite, he says to Ahab, he shows up here. So let's go to 1 Kings and go ahead and take a look. 1 Kings 17. Now, I'm going to go ahead and read through some of this. So we see 1 Kings 17. And Elijah the Tishbite, read along if you will, of the inhabitants of Gilead said to Ahab, so Elijah shows up here, okay? That's where we're at. He just shows up. We know God sent him. He comes to Ahab and he says, as the Lord of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years except at my word. Then when the word of the Lord came to him saying, get away from here and turn eastward and hide by the brook Cherith. God is telling Elijah, which flows into the Jordan, and it will be that you shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord, for he went and stayed by the brook Cherith, which flows into Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. And it happened after a while that the brook dried up, because there had been no rain in the land. So why again is a drought bad for this place? What's another thing Baal was a god of? Rain. So God's making some points here. He has the long, Pam and I were talking this tonight, you know, God's good on the long game, right? It's delayed punishment or delayed fulfillment, but it's going to happen. God does something for Elijah here. And you look at the text, he takes him away and he's going to give him an escape route, number one, to the Cherith Ravine. So we have Elijah show up and tell Ahab there's going to be a drought. Okay? Ahab goes away. And I want to quickly touch on this. As it leads up the story, a couple of important things. We won't read the whole thing, but what happens here, if you read the text later, you see that, you know, he goes away to the ravine, right? And he's fed by the ravens, so that's important. We see ravens pop up a lot in the Bible. God feeds him. God gives him water for a while, with 3 years, I believe. And then it dries up. And then he says, okay, you need to go somewhere else. Now, do you have any idea? He tells him in verse 8, he says, the Lord says, arise and go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Who's from Sidon? Jezebel. He sends him to enemy territory, hide in plain sight. I'm not going to pull the map back up, but he sends him all the way up nearly to enemy grounds. He's right there. And actually, he's pretty smart. You know, why would you look for him there? So they do that, and, you know, so they have an interaction, and this is good. This shows, this is not super a part of what's about to come, but it does show Elijah, God blesses this woman so that she'll not run out of food and oil. The woman has a son who dies, and Elijah intercedes for this pagan woman, right? And when he intercedes, I like this woman because she says, after in the story, if you read it, she says, how dare you? I say, you came here to make a fool of me. Is this, basically, she says, is this one of your moments for Yahweh? Is you gonna, you know, is this one of your times? You're gonna look good, you know. And he prays to God and he says, bring him back, right? And God restores that son. And this woman, I think it's implied, she becomes a believer. Now, during all this going on, Elijah's had a chance already to see two miracles. He's been fed, he's brought someone back to life. Okay? So that's two. So now we come back to our map after Elijah's run all the way up here. That's where he went. And then he's told to come back, right? So if you look in 1 Kings 18, we're going to jump ahead now, okay? 1 Kings 18, verse 1. And it came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the earth. So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab, and there was severe famine in Samaria. That's where he is. And Ahab had called Obadiah, who was in charge of his house. Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, for so it was while Jezebel massacred the prophets of the Lord. Okay, so she's been busy, that Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them 50 to a cave and fed them with bread and water. And Ahab had said to Obadiah, go into the land to all the springs of water and to all the brooks, so we might find grass to keep the horses and mules alive, so they will not kill the livestock. Okay, so we're going to skip down here to verse 7. Now, as Obadiah was on his way, so Elijah shows up and runs into Obadiah, right? And he recognized him and fell on his face and says, is that you, my lord Elijah? Says, it is I. Go tell your master, Elijah is here. And I like Obadiah here. Look, verse 9 says, have I sinned? You are delivering your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? What's he afraid of? He's afraid if he goes to Ahab, you mean you go tell him you're here? He's going to kill me for not, you know. Obadiah's kind of working covert operations here. Right? He's kind of helping out, we notice, some of the prophets here. When he says he is not here, you know, he says he took an oath from the kingdom or nation that they could not find you. Down to verse 11. Now you say, go tell your master Elijah is here. You know, basically, he'll kill me. And it shall come to pass, as soon as I'm gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you to a place I do not know. And when I go tell Ahab, he will kill me. So he's afraid, right? When it was not reported, verse 13, to my Lord what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets. Does anybody remember what that is in verse 13 if you keep reading? What is it that says Obadiah did to make Jezebel angry, had she found out? What does it say she did, or he did? He hid the prophets. He saved a few, right? Okay, so we'll skip ahead here. And Elijah says, the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will present myself to him today. So we'll skip ahead a bit here in the text to verse 17. So an arrangement happens, right? Elijah shows up. Ahab has to be careful. I love Ahab shows up here and he says, is that you, O troubler of Israel? Makes me think of, you know, it's just, you know. And then, of course, Elijah says, me, you know. I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, and that you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Therefore, send and gather all of Israel to me on Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. He's calling them all out. Now, this is big. From a cultural standpoint, this is when you can kill Elijah. They're having a battle of clerics here, right? These are clergymen. When you put it on, now you're saying, we're going to have a one-on-one. We're about to do a miracle, okay? They know what's coming. Now they'll have something to do. They'll have a way. If Elijah fails here, they can kill him. And probably the people will say, well, I guess Jezebel was right. But if Elijah wins, well, we'll see. So we have a few things here, and I think the questions here I've kind of answered, but the other prophets we see of Yahweh in verse 4 and 13 have been hidden. Or they've been killed, okay? So there are others, and let's remember that. But our main scene is Elijah is wanting to invite all these 850 here because it's time for him to show God's power, right? Let God work. But it is one versus 850, okay? That's a lot of people. So let's remember that. So we're going to jump ahead just a little here. Look at my time. Oh, yeah. So 18, verse 16. Let's go to chapter 18. So jumping ahead, we set up here, and they go to the altar. They go to Mount Carmel. They gather around and set up the two altars, right? Okay. So I'm going to jump to verse 16, all right? Okay. Now, next, let's jump ahead to verse 20 because we've already got the prophets there. So these are the highlights of what happens. Ahab sends for all the children of Israel. They gather together. Elijah came, and notice what he does, right? He's got the audience, but what does he do? He turns to Israel, right? And then he says, how long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord is God, if Yahweh is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. It's time to choose, right? I think the people probably showed up for a show, but now they're front row and they're participants. Elijah says, I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, okay? But Baal's prophets are 450 men. Therefore, let them give us two bulls. Cut it into pieces, lay on the wood, put no fire under it. He gives the instructions. He says, I'll call the name of the Lord. He answers by fire. He is God, right? If you call the name of your Lord and he answers by fire, he is God. Sound fair? Sure, let's do it. So all the people answered, it is well spoken. And Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one for yourself, for you are many. Call the name of your God and put no fire. So some of the text here will summarize, but as we go through here, we're going to see the competition, right? And I do want to focus on this part because it's funny, okay? I've always loved this part. But, you know, what we have here is they set up and he lets the Baal prophets go, right? And they begin their ritual. It doesn't give us explicit, but that this, they dance, they sing, they go all day. But what they did was they would shred their clothes, they would cut themselves, they would have, you know, these ritual. It was an orgy. That's what it was. And they would do this all day. Nothing happened. And I do love this part. Call it arrogant, call it confident. I don't know. But I do like this part. So if we read where in verse 27, he says, and so it was at noon, Elijah mocks them and said, cry aloud, for he is a god. Maybe he's meditating, or he's busy. Perhaps he's on a journey, or perhaps he's sleeping and must be awakened. I didn't like that. Now, does anybody else have a different translation or no?
English Standard.
Yeah, what does yours say? When it says, perhaps he is busy.
Maybe.
Yeah, that's the first potty humor joke in the Bible. Did y'all know that? So in Hebrew, I want to jump to this because that's what it says. In one of the translations, it says he is either occupied or perhaps he's gone aside. Gone aside is the Hebrew phrase for he's in the bathroom. So he's literally saying perhaps your God's on the toilet. If God doesn't come through here for Elijah, it's bad news for Elijah, right? Which is good. This is God putting it out. This is Elijah putting it out. So let's give it for him. But I have to be thinking, too, if I'm Elijah, this better work. This is as insulting as you can get. If this doesn't work, Elijah will die here today. That's no contest. And I just sort of read this. I'm like, that Michael Scott from The Office, yep, he's sort of biting his lip. You know. We jump ahead here as we read through verse 27 and 36. It goes forward, and I want us just to kind of cover what happens. You know, Elijah, he says he's the only prophet left. Is he the only believer left? See, a no. That's important. I think this is one area where Elijah maybe falters a little. And what's different, though, look at verse 27 and verse 36. Look at those verses. And so at noon, he mocked them, cried aloud. They cried aloud and cut themselves with knives and lances until blood gushed out and prophesied. No voice. What does Elijah do in verse 36? Someone want to tell me? At the time of the offering, it says, let it be known that you are God in Israel and I am your servant. I have done all these things at your word. And then what does he say after that? Verse 37. First words there.
Answer me.
He prayed, right? All that bombast, and Elijah gets down and prays. Now it's my turn. It's my God's turn. It's funny how he takes the silence here. At this point, later he has a little bit of a problem with it. But we know what happens here. He ups the ante here in verse 31 to 35, just to summarize. I don't have time to read the whole text. But you remember what Elijah does here? What does he do to his altar after they try?
Pours water.
Pour water on it. Dig a trench. Wet it. What are you doing, Elijah? Right? I love it. I love it. The guts here, right? And then, of course, he goes forward, and he's trying to show them that Yahweh God is master of earth, fire, wind, and water. Not the band, earth, fire, water. But earth, fire, water, and wind. 36 to 40, we see God have a thorough victory. And we see Elijah, as we get to the end here, just to kind of jump ahead, we see him get up and call down the Lord. And in verse 38, the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust. What else did it lick up? The water and the trench, it just consumed everything. That's a mic drop moment, right? He drops the fire, and I love this moment, right? It happens, and I can just imagine Elijah. All the people see it fall down. The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. Okay. I just, it's me reading. I can just imagine Elijah turning, because it says the fire happens. He turns to the people, sees the prophets of Baal, right? Do not let one of them escape. That's a good thing, because Ahab doesn't do that, right? He has some mercy later he shouldn't have. So they seize them. Who was it that seized the prophets?
The people.
That's important, right? But Elijah takes them to the sword, right? Takes them down to the brook Kishon and executed them there. That word is not by accident. This was an execution. These people were to be put down as an affront to God, right? And then in verse 41 to 46, if we jump ahead, the drought is going to come to an end, right? We get down, let's jump ahead to verse 41. Elijah then turns, and I love this, right? I can imagine he takes them all down to the brook, and then he turns to Ahab. Go up, eat and drink, for there's the sound of an abundance of rain. And Ahab went up to eat and drink, and Elijah went down, went up to the top of Carmel, and it says he bows down, face between knees, and tells his servant to go look toward the sea, right? Now, the people are still here, okay? And he goes and looks, and he comes to Elijah and says, there is nothing. And how many times does Elijah tell him to go back?
Seven.
Now, there's a lot of things going on with the number seven here. But the seventh time in verse 44, he sees a cloud as small as a man's hand rising from the sea. From the sea comes the cloud. Go up, Ahab, says Elijah. Prepare your chariot and go now before the rain stops you. I mean, that's pretty funny too, right? He says, you better go because I just brought the rain and I don't know how these people are going to act, right? And that's funny. I mean, I think it is. And you got to, Ahab's a coward. Okay, that's why I have no respect for Ahab. Ahab is pathetic. He's a terrible example of everything a man shouldn't be, a ruler shouldn't be. He is a terrible believer. He compromises. Jezebel, at least, is who she is. I'll say that. I have respect for Jezebel from being who she is. In the same way that Jesus says, I'd rather you be hot or cold. If you're lukewarm, I'll spit you out. Does that make sense? I'm not a Jezebel fan. But I'm saying, at least that woman says, I don't care. And that's the kicker here. And that's always shocked me. And one thing I'll mention here, this is Michael's speculation, but also things from culture. I think seven means a lot. We see in the Bible used to represent things. But I will say this, and I tend to believe God, again, knows what he's doing. A really cool bit of mythology here. Seven times he does this. And in the Baal cycle, Baal has seven several times. And particularly, all those things y'all read in Psalms, they claim Baal does. He talks about Baal is constantly going down to the underworld, and he does it. And if he wins and beats the god of death, he'll have seven good years. If he loses, they have seven bad. He's claimed to carry seven arrows of lightning. He slayed a seven-headed dragon. I just think that's kind of neat. I'll leave it to you. God left nothing to chance here. Okay? And as we get to our last few minutes, I did want to get to this. In 1 Kings 19, I at least want to read the first part here. We jump ahead, and it says there's a miraculous event here, right? At the end of, in verse 46, where it says, the hand of the Lord came upon Elijah, girded up his loins, and ran ahead of Ahab, okay? for time, we kind of have a miracle here. Now, why does Elijah go ahead of Ahab, and he hides and watches? Why do you think he does that? What do you think Elijah's looking for? It says he goes to the palace and waits. I think it's interesting he does. Maybe he just wants to see. But in verse 1, we see Ahab tells Jezebel, Jezebel, look what Elijah did. You know, I can't believe that we lost. He executed the prophets. What will we do? What does Jezebel say? She says, get a messenger. Tell Elijah, so let the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow at this time. I don't know about you, but if I'd just done that with as Elijah, I wouldn't expect to hear that from Jezebel, right? And I think this is where Elijah balks, right? He kind of, I think he was going to say, oh, this is the moment. She's going to repent or bow down and say, but she doesn't. And I think that's important to remember, everybody. Some people just reject God. Okay? And Jezebel was one of those. Jezebel was too proud. And we see him leave. At what I would say the end of our story, before it picks up later with Ahab and Jezebel, in 1 Kings 19, verse 9, I'll try to read this and we'll wrap. You know, Elijah runs. He goes very far. We see in verse 4 onward. Goes into the wilderness, hides under a broom tree. And he says, God, take my life, for I'm no better than my father's. And he slept, and God sends an angel, right? And what does he tell him? He says, eat. Eat. Okay? He goes forward. He tells him to eat and drink, take a nap, go to bed, right? Calm down. Gets up and eats again, goes to bed. He wakes up the next day, and God takes him to Horeb, the mountain of God. What happened at Horeb? Anybody remember that? Mount Horeb? It's in the Mount Sinai chain. That's where God took Moses. So he takes Elijah back to the beginning. Okay? And I know we're at time, but I want to leave this. I want you to think about this. Read this passage and we'll close. He says, I want you to go, and he says, go to a cave, spend the night in that place. And he says, what are you doing here, Elijah? And Elijah says, I've been very zealous for you, the Lord of God, God of hosts, your covenant. I've torn down their altars. I've killed the people who've killed your prophets with swords. I alone am left, right? And they seek to take my life. And this part I love, because this is where God says, go out, Elijah, unto the mountain. And behold, the Lord passed by a great and mighty wind, a whirlwind, tore into the mountains and breaks the rocks. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind was an earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after that was a still, small voice. And all we have in that scene is Elijah hearing it, and he's telling him, where are you, Elijah? Right? He's reminding him in that moment, Elijah, and he goes on in the text here. He points out there are 7,000 faithful back there where you just ran from. This was never about you. Right? There are 7,000 faithful to me. I have one more job for you. And Elijah gets it, right? He's telling him, I'm right here, Elijah. This was the problem from the whole time. I don't need the temple, okay? But we're going to fix this. And the last thing he does is sends Elijah on to, I want you to get a new prophet. Elisha's going to take your place. You're going to crown the new king of Damascus, Hazael. That's where he shows up. You're going to overthrow Ben-Hadad. And you're going to anoint Jehu the king. And I want him to murder every person in Ahab's house. And that's where we'll pick up next time, okay? Thank you all for the class. I hope you enjoyed it.